we are evaluating if the effect of an ingredient or a nutrient is through the microbiome. Sometimes that's not always the case, and I think there's a lot of noise in microbiome research still that a lot of labs are really addressing. Is it's kind of a chicken or egg situation. Is the change in the microbiome causing the disease that we're seeing, or is it an outcome? But still, well, there are opportunities in this space because we can utilize a fecal sample from a dog or a cat. Dogs much easier than cats, where it's non-invasive. We can get a one-time sample. We can do these in large, high-throughput screening formats, so we can test lots of different things. But I really think what's most interesting is the diversity of the populations you can get, because you don't need to keep animals on study.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Blending passion for customer success with love for pet nutrition, Trow Nutrition. Chemin Pet Food and Rendering is dedicated to supporting longer, fuller pet lives. Biorigin, your partner in yeast ingredients for palatability, immunity, and nutrition. Trusted ingredients, proven performance. Rengen Pet Nutrition, we partner with a purpose.
Welcome to the Pet Food Science Podcast, powered by Wisenetics, where we break down the science driving the global pet food industry. If you're a nutritionist, product developer, veterinarian, or decision maker, this is your space. We cut through the noise, from emerging research and regulatory shifts to ingredient innovation and sustainability, and we focus on what actually impacts what's in the bowl. I'm your host, Dr. Kate Shovler, professor of companion animal nutrition at the University of Guelph, with over 20 years of experience working alongside industry to turn science into practice. So let's dive into today's episode and talk about research on pet health ingredients. Today, we are joined by Kristen Kraft from Chemin Pet Food and Rendering. Dr. Kraft is a health and well-being scientist who obtained their PhD in animal science from Iowa State University, where she focused on the interaction between nutrition, immunity, and the microbiome and its role in animal health. Dr. Kraft has conducted research in multiple species, culminating in 18 peer-reviewed publications and a science-first, species-second approach to research. She joined Chemin in 2024 and has been leading the health and well-being R&D team since starting. Welcome, Kristen.
Hi, thank you for having me today.
Well, it's my pleasure. That was a little bit of a short bio, so I was hoping for the listeners you might give them a little bit more about your career journey to this point.
Okay. My career journey, I don't know how far back we want to go, but I actually got my start in zoo animals. So I did some job shadowing as a zoo nutritionist, and that's what really got me interested in this field. During my undergraduate training, I really tried to focus on companion animals. That, I think, was as close as I could get to that comparative nutrition education. And then when the time came for graduate school, I got in contact with my major professor, and though her program is poultry nutrition and immunology, her culture is very comparative as well. So this allowed me to really dive into my interest in nutrition while keeping the research across species. And in the process of that, though my goal had always been to be a nutritionist, ended up discovering that I am passionate about immunology. And so that kind of intersection between food and health and what that means at the molecular level, and then really took off from there.
Excellent. Well, I think that that plexus between nutrition and immunology is now an area where so many of us are starting to focus. And I think that it really frames the conversation that we're about to have today.
Perfect.
Chemin Pet Food and Rendering is driven to deliver safe, high-quality ingredients that enhance pet food and help pets live their best lives. Every day, we provide specialized expertise, innovative solutions, and dedicated support across the value chain, from freshness and palatability to nutrition, health and well-being, and tailored services. At Chemin, we take science as seriously as cats take cat stuff. Expert insight, meticulous testing, and decades of research go into every ingredient we create, ensuring consistent quality and proven performance. Longer, fuller pet lives start with Kemin.
So let's get started. I thought maybe I would first ask, what are the biggest challenges, may they be either scientific or practical, for research in the pet and well-being space?
Yes. So I would say, coming from a livestock background, when we're talking about nutritional immunology, some of the biggest challenges are really changing the way your brain works and how you're thinking about the different models. Practically and scientifically, with our livestock species, if we want to ask a question about what a nutrient is doing during a disease challenge, we can challenge those animals. With companion animals, that is absolutely not going to happen. We like to keep them healthy. We like to keep them happy. And when we're doing research on companion animals, we're relying very heavily on fecal samples and blood samples for a lot of those molecular markers. When we're talking nutritionally, if we're thinking about where we're applying these nutritional interventions, it's going into that digestive tract. When it comes to fecal samples, that's more representative of the large intestine or the lower GI. So if there's an effect more upstream, there's a better chance that we're going to miss it. That is something we just have to accept with these companion animal models. And then when it comes to the blood is representative of everything that's happening throughout the body. It is, of course, not specific to the GI tract. So oftentimes we might not really see a change, because anything that is happening in that GI tract is probably diluted, so to speak, when it's going out into that systemic circulation. So it's keeping in mind that a lot of our more molecular and mechanistic approaches to evaluating health and well-being. Me as an immunologist, I love cytokines and I love immune cell types. They're not always useful in companion animals the way they might be for livestock research. And that's where we have to rely more on what the animal is telling us, things that are more clinically relevant. So are they having less itching problems? Are they maybe perceived as less anxious? We're having to rely on more zoomed out than zoomed in, which as a nutritional immunologist is a very different mindset to shift into.
That's an interesting, your last point. In I call them owner noticeable indices that we should be measuring. But I also struggle with whether we should be quantifying those, or we should be asking the owner whether they notice a phenotypic change in their animal that could be caused by that change we would measure. Do you have any insights on talking to the owners and surveying the owners versus test directly in the animal?
That is a great question. So I do like to ask the owners. Generally, when it comes to companion animals, and this, I guess, might be straying a little off topic, but when we're talking about university research kennels or just research kennels in general, these are animals that they live a very controlled life, whereas our pets, they're very different. And so I think the human voice associated with the pets in a house carries a lot of weight. And so I like the owner surveys. I think they know their animals, they know what they're looking for, but it has to be the right survey. You don't want to lead an owner into telling you what you want to hear as a scientist. You want to keep it as objective as possible. You don't want to steer the research into what you want to hear.
Yeah, definitely. I think that also is the case when we look at just using surveys. We started down that path, and I very quickly started working with an economist who did a lot of consumer knowledge. And it became very clear that a ton of the surveys that are in the companion animal space have overt biases just in the way that they have been handled, let alone the questions that they've been asked. And I think that we really need to take an objective objective evaluation of even the things that are in the peer-reviewed literature doesn't necessarily mean that they were conducted without bias, which can be distributing via Facebook as an example. There's inherent bias there versus we use a controlled, we use a third party to release all of our surveys, and we pay to access all their survey respondents so we can structure it and tell them, you know, we want 50% women and 50% men as an example, or we want all of our people to be from the United States, and or we want an even split between the United States and Canada. So we get really specific with our demographics. So I think the survey, that becomes really important. What about, I want to bring you back because it's a hot topic as well. You very briefly mentioned cytokines and not having an immune challenge. Is there any value? Because we see cytokines being measured everywhere. And there are differences in disease states, but it's very difficult to capture differences in plasma cytokines. Is there any way to look at inflammation status that doesn't use plasma cytokines?
That is a great question.
Or is there maybe a better immune marker? I mean, you know a lot more about immunology than I do, and it's just... there's got to be this flow of immune responses, but how do we capture those, to your point, in an animal? You could probably capture them with a blood sample, but how do you time that blood sample around that event?
And I think that is one of the big questions. It's how acute is the challenge. I mean, some of these cytokines will happen very quickly. Some more associated with the adaptive immune system, you're going to expect them to occur later. I think there is a habit of picking one or two that appear frequently and then working with them. But if we're talking about, let's say for companion animals, something as stressful as transit. So I think putting them in a car for 2 hours, they're going to have a stress response that's going to be very acute. So you wouldn't want to drive them around for 2 hours and then measure blood a week later. Chances are you're going to miss them. They've already settled down. The downside to that is taking the blood draw is also inherently stressful. That is really a challenge with these models. And so it's really knowing which cytokines you're measuring, which cells are responsible for them, when you should expect those cells, to show up. And oftentimes with, I would say, any species, we don't have a very clearly defined timeline of when to expect these things. Sometimes we've taken that data from human vaccine studies, and we're saying it's going to be the same for a dog or a cat. It could actually be shorter. It could be longer. It's tough to tell. So for things like vaccines, where you know very early on you want this acute inflammation, I would focus on markers that are associated with the more innate immune response. Anything associated with, like if we're talking about a vaccination that's going into the tissue, you would want to look at anything associated with macrophages. The downside is macrophages are tissue. Their monocyte precursors are circulating in blood. That's where it gets a little tough. And so you would want to look at more markers associated with those first responders. And then in the weeks after, as we're transitioning from this very innate, very immediate response, you're going to want to look at those later, more adaptive immune cell markers, things like T cells, B cells. Sure, the cytokines, how they communicate with each other, but also the outputs. So anything related to a vaccine response. I think the other element of that is for vaccine responses, we're talking about antibodies. We tend to look at these broad classes of antibodies, so IgA, IgG, but just because you have an increase in, say, IgG, are you actually an increase in your vaccine-specific IgG? And those tests are very difficult to come by.
Interesting. So you've started talking about vaccines, and that made me wonder whether we have a broader opportunity to try to use the vaccine, the vaccination schedule of pets as an opportunity to investigate diets that can support the immune response. Because in I do a lot of work in protein and amino acids. And as we've kind of moved along with our different outcomes, which is very similar to the conversation we're having here today, our amino acid requirements have gone up in other species. I will be pushing for it in the dog. But I call this the survive at the lower level versus the thrive at the higher level. So that ability to be more resilient. So should we be structuring all of our work around the vaccination schedule so we can get that challenge that might differentiate our animals?
Ideally, yes. I mean, and I will say, I think in every conversation we have about nutritional immunology, of course, the most important thing is just adequate nutrition as a foundation. I think it's very easy to get lost in these very small ingredient changes, but at the end of the day, baseline nutrition, so absolutely adequate amino acids, will go a long way. With vaccine schedules, where it gets tough, and I will say, working here at Kemen, I do work closely with a veterinarian for this exact reason, because I am trained as a nutritional immunologist, not a clinician. My understanding of vaccine schedules is what I can read about, but maybe not always practical. So vaccine schedules are not always optimized to hit the lag, so that immune response might taper off. Sometimes we'll find that dogs still have protective immunity when they receive a booster and part of their vaccine schedule. So when we're doing vaccine challenges in adult animals, oftentimes they still have protective immunity, even if we are using that clinically relevant vaccine schedule. So we could try to time it, but it would almost be that you would have to source animals that actually do have that waning vaccine response. Where there's more opportunity would be in naive animals that have never encountered vaccines, so puppies and kittens. But of course, our understanding of the nutritional requirements at these life stages has quite a ways to go. They are not small adults. They have quite different needs at that time. So that's really an opportunity immunologically and nutritionally in a life stage that really sets the foundation for a health span, is to, I think, maximize these kinds of vaccine challenges in our younger animals. Adult animals, they present those unique challenges and nuances. You would want to find a vaccine they've never encountered before, which can be very tough, especially since a lot of those new vaccines don't also have a specific titer test. So it's a tough match.
Yeah, definitely. So I really hear you on the if you're going to use vaccines, it should be a vaccine that the animal has not seen before. So it'll elicit the greatest immune response, which is where you could probably delineate. So there's the challenge of working with dogs and cats, but I came from the animal model world originally as well. And I think that this is quite fascinating in dog and cat, that we very rarely talk about whether there's an appropriate animal model. Do you feel like there are some alternative animal models or in vitro models that could help us develop and innovate more rapidly?
I do get concerned about stating the obvious here, but every model has gaps. I think the perfect model, of course, is the animal you want to do the study in, but everything has its nuances and caveats. So we have explored some alternative models. If we're talking about in vitro, I think one that's really fascinating, and there's been quite a few out there, are any in vitro or ex vivo models that evaluate the microbiome. These are very useful. I do want to say, for if we are evaluating if the effect of an ingredient or a nutrient is through the microbiome. Sometimes that's not always the case. And I think there's a lot of noise in microbiome research still that a lot of labs are really addressing is it's kind of a chicken or egg situation. Is the change in the microbiome causing the disease that we're seeing, or is it an outcome? But still, well, there are opportunities in this space because we can utilize a fecal sample from a dog or a cat. Dogs much easier than cats, where it's non-invasive. We can get a one-time sample. We can do these in large, high-throughput screening formats, so we can test lots of different things. But I really think what's most interesting is the diversity of the populations you can get, because you don't need to keep animals on study. These are puppies, kittens, animals living with diseases, those that are healthy, different diet formats. You can really evaluate a lot of things in this sort of high throughput screener and evaluate in a very diverse population consistent change patterns. So maybe not focusing specifically on a specific bacteria. So sometimes I think we get lost in looking at a genus, but looking more, I think, broadly, do you see a change in fiber degraders? Do you see a change in protein fermenters? Do you see that their outputs are different? And these formats allow you to look a little bit at not only the composition of that microbiota, but the compounds they produce, and then using our available literature, sort of giving us an area to look for on how that might impact things like immunity. It's not going to replace an animal study, but it is going to tell us more what to look for and to refine it further. And so if we're seeing an effect in maybe some other models, things like cell culture, but we're not seeing an effect in the microbiota, when we take that into an animal model, we can maximize our research efforts by taking what we don't think is going to work out of it, if that makes sense. So we have those in vitro or ex vivo microbiota models. One that I'm interested in and very fascinated about is Caenorhabditis elegans, the nematode models, or these worm models. They offer kind of an interesting microscopic animal where we can leverage their homology and their use in human preclinical models to get some insights I think do translate to pets. So things like gut barrier function, lipid deposition, and then by virtue of their short lifespan, even evaluating some potential longevity. And so they've been used in these contexts for humans, but they really present an opportunity for pets as well.
Yeah, and I think maybe the only thing that I would add to that is I do find in pet, and not all, but there seems to be a lack of reading outside of dog and cat to a certain extent. And I think it's really important to recognize, while the dog and cat are unique, across the mammalian kingdom, the vast majority of physiology is to some degree maintained across these species, with major differences really predicated on anatomical and physiological idiosyncrasies is what really steers our understanding of the minute differences in metabolism between all terrestrial mammals. So I would really encourage everyone to do what you're doing as well, to read outside of the dog and cat literature. And I smiled when you said longevity research with C. elegans, because we started there doing some longevity research as well, really understanding that. And fruit fly behavior, right? It's a continuum of understanding, and there's these things intact across species that are just fascinating as well.
Absolutely.
So could this also, I think about the reverse too. So we earlier on, we talked about the importance of surveying pet owners. Could we also survey pet owners to inform ourselves of things that we potentially don't know about in science?
Yes. I often have to laugh. One of the big adjustments coming from livestock research into pet research is that We do have to consider human psychology and everything we're doing. And that's where pet parents can give us some really good scientific insights as well. I think as scientists, we can look at the data and say that obesity and overweight problems in pets are huge. And then you can look at other surveys that indicate that 70% of pet parents don't agree on what is a healthy weight. And so it's maybe not at the benchtop, but it can give us some insights in how we as scientists communicate the issues, sort of how pet parents are thinking. They're thinking very differently than livestock producers, and what really the barriers are. And so pet parents have very different understandings of what their pet's health needs really even are. I think when I tell people what I do for a living, I get asked a different question every time about what it is a certain pet parent might be interested in. So I think that can really guide our questions scientifically, but then also our approaches to communicating that science to the general public.
Yeah, I agree. I also have exactly the same interaction when people find out what I do. But what's most fun is I probably have a handful of people from the public who I've never met, who I've become their email buddy with for their pet. I usually keep responding because they're really lovely and they see difference and they're very enthusiastic and open to education, right? So it usually becomes quite fun. So maybe last but not least, because there's a tremendous amount of literature and I've definitely contributed to it, or my lab has, where we have failed to find a difference between two diets on all of these outcomes that we're talking about and more when it pertains to digestion and metabolism. Can you talk a little bit about what a lack of difference may or may not mean in the context of nutrition?
What I always reminded my students of when I was in graduate school and mentoring undergraduates is that no response is still a response. No effect is still an effect. I think when we read the literature and we see these studies that are so, quote, successful, they're showing these differences, it's easy to think that every study you do should follow suit. But sometimes nutritionally, what it means is no negative effect. So if we have healthy animals and we're feeding them these two different diets and we're not seeing any differences, we're not causing a downgrade in their health status. We're not causing harm, so to speak. It could be that, again, what is healthier than healthy is, I think, a big question to always be asking. That's really tough to quantify. It's tough to really shift a healthy, balanced system in a way that's measurable. And so recognizing that you can design a study, and often nutritionally we're designing studies that are isocaloric, so we're not providing more energy, we're not giving them a reason to gain weight differently or behave any differently. It's really in some ways a confirmation that nutritionally we did accomplish our objectives of not causing a significant shift. But I think it is equally important to recognize that no effect just tells us the next steps. I think when we do a research study, we have these hypotheses, but we forget sometimes, I think, that we're asking a question we don't know the answer to. So we have a hypothesis, we do the research, and the data speaks for itself and doesn't always support our hypothesis, and that's okay. There's still value in what the data are saying. And I think there's value in publishing some of those no effects to tell people that, hey, this is the foundation. This is what we've tried. There's no effect here, but take a look, see where the gaps are, and let's build on this further.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And And I recently had an interaction with an undergraduate research student of mine who had hypothesized a difference between two dietary treatments, and there was none. And it caused them quite a bit of distress until I started to break down exactly what you said. Well, it's okay to be wrong. Scientists should be wrong all the time. It's actually important that we're wrong every once in a while, because those are discoveries, because we evaluated all the information we thought that was relevant to come to our objective and hypothesis. Then we designed a study to interrogate that question, and we had to reject our hypothesis, which means that all the information up to today led us to assume the wrong thing. And then one doing it once isn't enough. We'd have to replicate that in different ways and different designs to feel really confident that's the truth. But it's okay to be wrong. It's okay for your hypothesis to be wrong. And I couldn't agree more. It's absolutely okay to publish null results. And I think we should just publish everything, to be quite honest, is my opinion. I agree. And I think our trainees need to really hear that importance of both are valid, but follow your math and follow your science.
Absolutely. Yeah. I had a mentor in graduate school, he always said that if you put animals through it, I mean, we are animal researchers. If you are doing an animal study and you have put animals through it, that you should tell what the results are. Because at the end of the day, people need to know and not repeat. Or repeat for the scientific method. But at the end of the day, it needs to be known.
Yep. I absolutely agree. It saves animals in the long run from being used again. And maybe I'll give one more aspirational. There was a Canadian scientist. Everybody who's in the nutrition space may figure out who it is, who retired a couple of years ago. And I saw her a few years before she retired. And I said, "Oh, what are you doing for the last 3 years before you retire?" And she said, "I am publishing every single study I ever conducted." And that continues to be an aspiration of mine. I don't know if I will attain that, but she was definitely an inspiration to, if you're going to use them, publish it and keep that drumbeat.
Well, absolutely. Good luck.
Thank you. All right. Well, with that, thank you so much for joining us today on this topic about research and what we should consider. But I do have a few more questions for you.
It's time for our famous three.
So first, what is one key book that you need by your side?
That would be Janeway's Immunobiology. It lives next to me at my desk. I have several sections bookmarked. I know I talk about cytokines. There are so many that there are handy tables at the back to kind of get a refresher, because every IL starts to sound the same after a while. But that has been my go-to and my highly recommended immunology textbook.
Okay, great. I might order that book. Second question, what is a fundamental question about the nutrition and metabolism of dogs and cats that you think would really help us improve their health and well-being?
Let's see. I guess one question I always have is just when we're talking about metabolism, coming from a livestock background, we talk about energy transitioning to meat and milk production. And then in dogs and cats, we don't really have anything the same. You can't do a feed to companionship conversion. And so I guess one of my fundamental questions has always been, how do we evaluate the fate of nutrients in dogs and cats and what that means for their health and well-being? So we have apparent total tract digestibility, but what happens then? What does that mean for the available nutrients for their immune response? What does that mean for what's left over for the microbiome and how that interacts subsequently with the immune system? Is just fundamentally in dogs and cats, what happens when it leaves the gut?
I love it. I deal with this question all the time as well. And last but not least, dogs or cats?
It's a really close race. I will give it slightly to cats. I do love both, but in research, I've always loved the animals that give you a little bit of a challenge, that have a personality that might be a little feisty, and that would be cats for sure.
Absolutely. Very difficult to manage sometimes.
Yes.
And very difficult to plan your samples. So I would concur with you.
Yes. I like a challenge.
Absolutely. Yeah, they are a challenge for sure. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Kristen. It was a great conversation. We hope that you'll join us once again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that concludes another episode of the Pet Food Science Podcast presented by Wisenetics. Thank you for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to stay updated on future episodes. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please leave us a review. Until next time, this is Kate Shovler signing off from the Pet Food Science Podcast.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.